Hi, everybody, and welcome to English Digest. I'm Pat.
And I am Tom.
And today we are looking at our Newswatch article. We've got a couple of different stories, both with kind of a scientific focus. We're going to start with natural science, look at how some work is being done in the world of plant science to get plants to do something a little bit different that will help us deal with climate change. Then we're going to move over to some news about outer space kind of science and how a place that did a lot of early work in this field has now been recognized by part of the UN for its contribution. So, yeah, there's a whole range of different sciences here. Are you more interested in one area of science than another? Or?
Oh, I like science in general. Both of these stories are of interest to me, especially when we have things to do with plants. But also I'm into astronomy as well, so this planetarium in the Netherlands does sound quite interesting. So let's find out about these places right now, or these news stories to be more specific. Let's listen to our article read now from top to bottom. Plants geared up to absorb more carbon dioxide. In a groundbreaking effort to combat climate change, scientists are exploring advanced genetic engineering techniques to increase the carbon capture and storage capacity of plants. Their main goal is to develop crops that can actively absorb more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Research shows that while plants and soil currently absorb about 30% of the carbon dioxide released annually by humans, there is the potential to increase this by boosting plants' efficiency in photosynthesis. Experiments involving the genetic modification of proteins in plants have shown that this can lead to quicker adjustments to sunlight variations, allowing for more energy capture. Studies have shown promising results, with modified tobacco exhibiting up to 20% more growth. The larger a plant is, the greater amount of carbon it can store within its tissues. Similar outcomes in soybeans point to the potential widespread application of this technology. Alongside this attempt, scientists are investigating various methods to improve carbon capture through genetic engineering of plants. These innovative approaches, though still in early development, could significantly diminish the impacts of climate change.
Netherlands Isa Isinger Planetarium secures UNESCO Heritage Status. The Isa Isinger Planetarium in Franeker, Netherlands, has recently been added to the UNESCO World Heritage List in recognition of its status as the oldest functioning planetarium in the world. This accomplishment highlights the planetarium's historical and scientific significance dating back to the 18th century. Constructed between 1774 and 1781 by Isa Isinger, a wool merchant with a passion for astronomy, the planetarium is integrated into the ceiling of his living room. It features a mechanical scale model of the solar system, representing the Sun, Moon, Earth, and the other planets known at the time. The model operates in real time, showing the accurate movement of the planets around the Sun. Isinger's creation was a response to the widespread fear that a disaster might strike the world. With scientific evidence, he aimed to demonstrate that although the planets appeared to be close, they weren't going to crash into each other. UNESCO's recognition of the Isa Isinger Planetarium celebrates not only its technical achievements, but also its ongoing role in fostering public understanding of science.
Okay, it's time for us to gear up and talk about the lesson for today. We're talking, first of all, about plants gearing up to absorb more carbon dioxide. So here we've got the phrase to gear up. That just means you kind of get ready for something, but here it just means you increase the capacity of something. You might want to gear up when you're riding your motorcycle, for example. You start off in first gear, you move on to second gear, but when you're going faster, you're going to gear up to fourth or fifth gear so that you can go much faster.
So with these plants, it's almost in the passive voice. These plants are being geared up. They're not doing it themselves. They're being adapted. They're being changed by science. And they're being equipped, basically, to perform a new job. They're being given the tools in this case, to absorb more carbon dioxide. You'll know carbon dioxide. You might be equally familiar with its scientific name, the CO2. And I'm sure you'll be aware that this is something that we breathe out, that plants breathe in when they make their own energy. But it's also a greenhouse gas that we want a lot less of in our atmosphere because it traps the sun's rays, contributes to global warming and climate change. Dealing with the amount that humans and other animals produce is a big part of trying to make our Earth greener, safer, and better to live in. And we're working with plants, which do it naturally, but we need them to work a little bit harder because there's so much more.
There are lots of plants that can absorb or suck up carbon dioxide, but maybe there aren't enough of them, so we need to increase the plant's capacity to do this. And here in the first paragraph it says, in a groundbreaking effort to combat climate change, scientists are exploring advanced genetic engineering techniques to increase the carbon capture and storage capacity of plants. So first of all, we're talking about this effort as groundbreaking, which means it's never really been done before. It's the first time this has been done. And they want to fight or combat climate change. Here, combat as a verb means you have to stress the second syllable, combat, although sometimes people may pronounce combat as both the noun and the verb form, but technically you're supposed to say combat. They want to fight climate change, and in order to do that, scientists are exploring advanced genetic engineering techniques. If something has to do with genes, we say it's genetic. Genetic engineering means you kind of muck around with the genes in something to make them grow a different way. In this particular case, they want the plants to grow larger.
Yeah, genetic, your genes are your code. It's the DNA that codes your entire body and tells your body and its cells what to produce, when to produce it, and how to produce it. So by changing that code, by adding something in, taking something out, making something not work or work in a different way, you change the way that the plant grows. And that's what we're doing here. We want to increase the plant's ability to firstly capture carbon, which means to take it in from the air, and store carbon, so keep it in its body once it has been captured. So storage is the noun form of to store. To store something means to keep it for later use. So your storage capacity is the amount of something you can store within you. Capacity is the maximum amount of that thing. So your storage capacity and increasing it means plants can store more carbon dioxide in their structure. So they will take more out of the air. They will keep it more inside them. That is the key of what's going on here.
Right. Storage capacity could also refer to your computer, like how much storage capacity does your computer have? Sometimes that's just shortened to storage. How much storage do you have? Well, I have 2 terabytes of storage in my computer, and I'm going to upgrade to 4 terabytes in the future. But in this particular case, we're talking about plants being able to suck up or to take in carbon dioxide. So we're talking about carbon capture so we can take it out of the atmosphere so this carbon dioxide will not cause global warming. But again, the main goal of these scientists is to develop crops that can actively absorb more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So again, that's why we want to increase the storage capacity of plants, and they want to do this in order to absorb more carbon straight from the atmosphere, okay? So you don't have to worry about where you're getting carbon from. You don't have this carbon sequestering, as they call it. In this particular case, we get the plants there to suck up the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere directly. I understand that bamboo is good at that as well. Maybe we need to plant more bamboo.
Yeah, more plants in general would do it. But the problem is plants are fighting a losing battle because so much of the Earth's plants are being taken away to build houses and so on. So this is why we get to this next fact. Research shows that while plants and soil currently absorb about 30% of the carbon dioxide released annually by humans, there is the potential to increase this by boosting plants' efficiency in photosynthesis. So the first fact says, humans produce a large amount of carbon dioxide, and we release it annually. We breathe it out and produce it in other ways, by factories, by cars, by all that kind of stuff. and about 30% of it per year or annually is still currently absorbed by plants in the soil. Now, of course, that means the other 70% goes out there into the air, and that's what's creating the problems of climate change. So, as well as other means of reducing the amount of carbon we make, we think we can boost plants' efficiency, how good they are at photosynthesis. This is the process by which plants get energy. They take water from the ground and carbon dioxide from the air. They use the sun's light to kind of fire it up, almost like fuel, and they will turn that into sugar and oxygen. So they pump out good oxygen into the air for us to breathe, and they use their own sugar to grow.
Right, okay, so you want to increase the efficiency of plants in regard to photosynthesis. Again, this is to provide some extra ability for the plants to absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Again, we've got 30% of the carbon dioxide or CO2 released every year by humans being absorbed by plants. Again, annually just means every year. We could say this meeting is held annually. It's held once a year. And again, that's quite a lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and we need to increase the plant's efficiency in doing that. And they increase their efficiency in photosynthesis. Now, experiments involving the genetic modification of proteins in plants have shown that this can lead to quicker adjustments to sunlight variations, allowing for more energy capture. So again, if you change something in a certain way, you modify that certain thing. So we're talking about genetic modification. You probably heard of the term GMO, genetically modified. What's the O?
Organism.
Organism. Okay. Yeah. I couldn't think of the O, what that meant there. But again, GMOs have to do with changing the genes in something to get them to grow better, like a wheat or corn. Some of it is GMO. It's been changed genetically so that it can be more pest resistant or so that it can grow faster. So in this particular case, we're talking about genetic modifications of the proteins in plants. Protein is a kind of chemical that usually comes from meat, but it's also in plants. And that we need it as part of our diet. And, of course, if we make these modifications, then we can have these quicker adjustments to sunlight variations in the plants. So, again, I guess this means that if there's a lot of sunlight, they can absorb a certain amount of CO2. And if there isn't enough sunlight, they can still absorb it as well.
Yeah, or if there's even more sunlight, they can modify themselves to absorb that too. They can, no matter how much sunlight there is, the plants have got the right proteins, which in a plant, in an animal, proteins are almost like the little worker cells. They do all of these jobs. They build new things. They make energy. Proteins are our workers as well. They're inside the cells, but they're our little engines. So that's why we need to change them, which changing the DNA will do. And it seems to be working so far. Studies have shown promising results, with modified tobacco exhibiting up to 20% more growth. So they change these tobacco genes, they give them the ability to absorb more sunlight, and the tobacco grows by 20%, meaning it's making more energy, using more sunlight, and sucking in more CO2.
Right,
so it seems to work.
It does seem to work, and also that might be good news for smokers because there's more tobacco because the plants are bigger. But I think there are fewer and fewer people smoking these days.
Mm.
But in any case, a tobacco plant can have another purpose. It can suck up some more of that carbon dioxide from the atmosphere as a result of growing up to 20% larger. Now, the larger a plant is, the greater amount of carbon it can store within its tissues. Now, here we're not talking about tissue paper that you use to wipe up a spill or to blow your nose into if you have a cold. This is like the living organisms inside your body. It could be the muscles. It could be the skin. It's just the living part of your body. So it can store this carbon in the tissues of the plant. And, of course, that's if we have a larger plant.
Mm. So, it's working with tobacco. We've seen similar outcomes or results in soybeans point to the potential widespread application of this technology. So, similar outcomes means similar results when they modified soybean genes. The tobacco grew bigger, soybeans also grew bigger and stored more carbon, which means that maybe this can work for all kinds of plants. So, it's potentially, they haven't proved it yet, but it's possible. Widespread means it can be used in many things. So the fact that two plants have done this suggest that we could maybe make it work with all different kinds of different plants and not only grow more soybeans, which is pretty important for feeding people, but also suck in more carbon from the atmosphere and make the air better. So far, all looks pretty good.
Okay, let's continue now to the next paragraph as we finish off the first article. It says, alongside this attempt, or along with it, scientists are investigating various methods to improve carbon capture through genetic engineering of plants. So they're also thinking of ways to increase the amount of carbon dioxide that is sucked out of the atmosphere. And they're developing various ways or different methods to do this. They have one attempt, of course, we have in terms of making the plants bigger, but there are other things they're trying as well.
And these innovative approaches, though still in early development, could significantly diminish the impacts of climate change. So they're innovative, they are creative, they're using new ideas, they're using something that hasn't been done before. They're still in early development, so we do need to do a lot more testing, a lot more proving it really works. But if it does work, this could significantly diminish or reduce, lessen the impacts, the effects of climate change, which is something we know we all need to do and something we definitely want. So that's the end of the first news story. We're going to take a short break now and then we'll return with our second story.
Okay, let's continue now with the second part of our lesson for today. We've got a story coming from the Netherlands. We've got this ISA Isinga Planetarium, and it has secured UNESCO heritage status. So a planetarium, of course, is kind of like a museum in which they show us how the planets work. We've got big images of planets, and you can see how they move. I believe there's a planetarium in the Astronomical Museum up in Schurlin there. It's kind of fascinating, kind of interesting there. You can check out the planets there. They've got big mock-ups of the planets, and a planetarium, of course, or planetariums exists on all parts of the world, including this one in the Netherlands, and it has become a UNESCO heritage site, like a lot of places around the world. I don't know if there are any UNESCO sites here in Taiwan, but here we've got one in the Netherlands. It's a planetarium.
Yeah, UNESCO stands for the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization. And it's part of the UN, and its job is just to recognize anything that's important for a country's education, science or culture. And it's something that humankind needs to sort of appreciate and recognize and show off. And if you're on this list, if you're part of the heritage status, then you get a bit of extra protection. People aren't allowed to knock these buildings down or destroy these parts of the country just for fun. They really have to pay attention. They'll have funds to protect them. So what is this place? Well, it's the ISA Isinga Planetarium in Franeker, Netherlands. And we see it has recently been added to the UNESCO World Heritage List in recognition of its status as the oldest functioning planetarium in the world. So it's not only one of the oldest, but it still works. The stuff that was built there, as we'll find out well over 200 years ago, it still works. It still acts as somewhere people can go and see the way the planets move and they rotate around the sun. So the fact that it was built so long ago and still worked is a big achievement.
Yes, indeed. It's functioning. It's still working. And you can check this out if you go to the Netherlands. And this accomplishment highlights the planetarium's historical and scientific significance dating back to the 18th century. So here we've got an accomplishment that is just something you achieve. It's usually something that is difficult to do, but you do it successfully after having a lot of effort or spending a lot of time on it. So this is an accomplishment, again, something that has been achieved successfully. And it highlights or stresses the planetarium's historical and scientific significance. In other words, it lets us know about this place, and it lets us know that it has a history and that it has a scientific purpose to it. You can learn about the planets by checking this out. And again, it's the oldest functioning one, and it dates back to the 18th century. That just means it began in the 18th century. That's how old it is.
Yeah, we're going to find that out in the next sentence. We'll find out exactly when it was built. We see constructed or built between 1774 and 1781 by Isa Isinger, a wool merchant with a passion for astronomy, the planetarium is integrated into the ceiling of his living room. So he wasn't a scientist, he wasn't a researcher, he just happened to be a person who loved the planets and the stars. He was a wool merchant, so he bought wool from farmers and sold it to people who then made it into clothes or something else. He was just a businessman, but he had a passion for astronomy. Astronomy is the study of the stars and the way the planets move and where they are up in the universe and how they move around the sun and how often and things like that. So if you are into that kind of thing, you like astronomy. You are interested in the way that things move around in outer space. So he built this thing himself because he was so interested in it, and he integrated it into the ceiling of his living room. So he had a ceiling already. He just put all the planets, all these models in there, maybe used string or metal wires or whatever to hang them up and make them move. He just put it as part of his ceiling. So any guest, visitor would come into his living room and go, wow, what is that up there? Oh, that's the sun and all the planets, and look at the way they move. I just made them into my ceiling.
Must have been quite a conversation piece there to invite friends over, and they could check out the model of the planets there. It's integrated into the ceiling. It's a part of the ceiling in his living room, and it features a mechanical scale model of the solar system representing the sun, moon, earth, and the other planets known at the time. Okay, so this is what it includes. It features or has these things. It's a mechanical scale model of the solar system. If something's mechanical, it uses gears and springs and things like that. Maybe you have a mechanical watch, for example. If you bought a Rolex or something like that, it's probably going to be a mechanical watch. It's not going to be quartz. It's going to have gears and springs and things like that. And this is a scale model of the solar system. If it's a scale model, it's reduced in size. So you can buy models of, say, cars or military aircraft. They will be scale models, and they'll usually be expressed as a ratio as to how small it is compared to the real thing.
Yeah, like 1,000th or something like that. But with a scale model, what it does mean is that the proportions are right. So in the real solar system out there, Jupiter is much bigger than all the other planets. And so in this scale model, Jupiter will be bigger on his ceiling or in his ceiling or hanging from it than all the other planets, but by the same ratio. So if it's 4 times as big as the Earth, say, in real life, then the model one will be 4 times bigger than the model of the Earth. Everything will be right and everything will be accurate. So that makes it even more amazing. And it's, of course, a model of our solar system. The solar system is all the planets that move around our sun, the star at the heart of our group of planets. So that's everything from Mercury all the way to Pluto and all the kind of other different rocks and all the moons of the different planets that we have. Everything that's in there, the stuff you'll learn about in school, that is our solar system. Once you move beyond that, you're out of our system and into a different one.
Right, so the farther you get from the sun, the more planets there are out there, but of course, at the time, they didn't know all about those planets that were out there. I think Pluto was discovered in like 1932 or something like
that.
Yeah,
I think they probably didn't get much further than maybe Uranus, I think, as far as they got.
Or maybe as Neptune, I don't know, but they certainly would have seen Saturn and Jupiter because they're pretty bright in the night sky. But yeah, they knew about these planets at the time, so of course, we've got this mechanical scale model that includes the planets and the bodies that they knew about at the time. And the model operates in real time, showing the accurate movement of the planets around the sun. So if it's operating in real time, then it's reflecting the amount of time it takes for these bodies to circle the sun. So I think, for example, I'm not really sure if he actually does this, but the model of Jupiter should take like 11 years to go around the sun. So you need to hang out in his living room for 11 years to see Jupiter complete one revolution of the sun.
Yeah, but if you were following Earth, you could go in on January the 1st, 1 year, and go, okay, it's there. And in January the 1st, the following year, it'd be back to exactly where it was before. Mm. Others would be moving faster and slower, but it shows the accurate movement. So it doesn't just show them just going round and round. It actually shows the kind of the orbits, which aren't circular. They're these weird kind of elliptical oval shapes, and it'll show which ones are relatively higher and lower and further out and closer and everything like that. So why did he do this? Well, he loved planets, but he had another reason as well, which is explained in the next paragraph. Isinger's creation was a response to the widespread fear that a disaster might strike the world. So back a couple of hundred years ago, people didn't understand the way the planets move quite as well. Maybe the experts and the people who studied it did, but there was a widespread, a fairly common fear among many parts of society that one of these planets or one of the rocks or one of their moons would crash into them. Because if you just look at certain basic information, hey, that star's brighter than it was last night. Is it coming right for us? And people would have been scared and thinking that these planets might move in ways that cause them to hit Earth.
Exactly. So, of course, he's got this model and people think the planets are close together. And at certain times of the year, the planets may align with each other. And so people might think, oh, because all those planets are there, it causes an increase in gravity. I'm not sure if they knew about that back at the time. But in any case, they were probably very superstitious. And they thought, hey, those planets might cause disaster here on the world. Disaster might strike the world. And with scientific evidence, he aimed to demonstrate that although the planets appeared to be close, they weren't going to crash into each other. So yes, he demonstrated or showed that all of these planets follow a defined course around the sun, and they don't run into each other. They just freely circle around the sun, and they're actually millions of miles apart, so I don't think we have anything to worry about. Mars is not going to come crashing into the Earth ever.
But they would have looked close in the night sky, and that may have been enough for a lot of people to get afraid. So it's not just education here, it's kind of getting people to understand this is how things really work. It's not just for fun, this will make you feel a lot more comfortable about things like this. And that's why we say UNESCO's recognition of the Isinger Planetarium celebrates not only its technical achievements, but also its ongoing role in fostering public understanding of science. So yeah, one thing we want to celebrate is the technical achievement. Imagine how difficult it would have been in 1774 to 81 for a normal guy, a wool merchant, a business guy, to know enough and to have the time and to get all the mechanical tools to build something that really did work in real time and have the right size and to keep working year after year to show how it worked. That is an amazing technical achievement for something so long ago. So that's one thing that UNESCO hopes to recognize. The other one is helping people understand science, which is where we use this word foster. To foster something, in this case, means to encourage the development of something. And it's something positive. It's something that you want to happen. So to encourage the development of public understanding is desirable. We want more people to understand science. We want more people to understand the way the world works because it will help them feel more comfortable. It'll stop them making bad decisions based on the fact they don't understand things well. So fostering this kind of thing is pretty important. We can also use foster in the sense of a child being looked after by another family that will take care of him and take on responsibility for looking after that child.
Right. My roommate in college, for example, was a foster child because his parents died when he was quite young. He had to live with strangers, basically. And I think this is kind of amazing here because Isinger was a wool merchant. He sold wool, and so he still had time at night to pursue another passion in astronomy, so he built this planetarium, and that kind of lets us all know that you don't have to be bored by your job all the time. You can actually accomplish something in your free time, and this person is an example of that. And besides, it's in the Netherlands, and I hear that Dutch people are pretty cool, pretty chill, pretty cool to chat with and hang out with. So, hey, it's a good excuse to head there and check out this planetarium. Okay, that brings us to the end of our explanation for today. And that's all we're going to say for today, so please join us next time for another edition of our program. From all of us here at English Digest, I'm Tom.
And I am Pat.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.